Mike and recovery alcoholic.
Hi, Mike.
This is Adrian. Grateful to have him here. He's actually my sponsor, and he's going to do a four-week presentation with the Big Book on Love, and he may tell you a little bit more what the breakdown's going to be. But welcome, Adrian. We're glad you're here.
Thank you. Thank you.
About 7:30.
Okay, no problem. Good evening, everybody. My name is Adrian. I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Adrian.
Grateful to be here. Thank you for the invite. Nice to be back here. I was here a few years ago, and it's nice to see my friend again. That's one of the great things about AA. If you stick around, you know, and you visit different groups or different places, and you're active in it, and you come back, and you see that people are still here, and they're doing well, you know. And that always makes me feel good. So it does. So I've been asked to do a workshop with the Big Book on the theme of love. So I promise I'll try to put the word love in there a couple of times, you know. We'll see where it goes. You know, love and the Big Book, they're kind of inseparable. It's, you know, my home group is the Saturday Morning Beginners Big Book Meeting, and I've been continuously sober from February 18th, 2001, And I'm grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. I really am. And, you know, the miracle is not just so much the time. Well, it's nice to have the time, you know. But it's not so much the time. It's what I've found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And maybe that's a question to the newbies. Or if you're around here for a while and you're kind of a little disorientated, or you think this AA thing still sucks, you know, what's everybody going on about in here, you know, and I've had that too. You know, maybe there's a question you can present to yourself is, what is it you're actually looking for in here? That's a great question to ask the newcomers when they walk in the door. That's what my sponsor asked me. What? Hey, hello, how you doing? Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. What are you looking for here? You know, and I thought I was coming here to solve a drinking problem, and, you know, it was reminded to me right away. When I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was sober. Now, there was times I came here drunk. And it's funny, the times you come here drunk, you always want to share. You always got something good to say, you know. And you're always annoyed when they don't call on you, you know. You think they don't know that you're drunk, you know. So, you know, and that's, like, we have greeters in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think greeters are one of the most important jobs in AA, because we get to see people coming in off the street for the first time. And a great question to ask someone when they come in off the street the first time is, what is it you're looking for here? You know, I didn't come to AA to get sober. I was sober when I got here. I hadn't drank for 36 hours or in around that. By myself, I'd done that. And, you know, in 14 years of solid, heavy drinking, I managed to maybe pull a week or 2 weeks together if I was in hospital or something. So I really didn't have much recollection or sobriety, you know. And when I did get here, you know, my journey started in Belfast in Ireland. You know, that's where there's no democracy in where you're born. You know, you don't get to pick the time, the place. You know, you don't even have much control when you get here. You don't get to pick your name or, you know, I got Adrian. You know, that was my first resentment, you know. Oh, my God. I went through my life with a resentment with my mother calling me Adrian because, you know, the movie Rocky and stuff, Adrian was a girl. And I thought Adrian was such a feminine name until I was dating this girl one time and I told her. And she said, really? It sounds like a really masculine name, like a Roman emperor or something. And then kind of got rid of the resentment, you know. I was like, I started to see myself differently after that, you know. But, you know, the love in the Big Book, you know, the longer I'm here and the more I do this, you know, and I've done this many times. And I'm not saying that to kind of show off or whatever. I've done it many times because I'm a sick dude and I need to. You know, I've needed to. I'm the kind of guy that needs extra help. You know, I need extra help with the Big Book. I need extra help with the sponsor. I've needed extra help in spiritual circles outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the more I do this and the more I actually look at this, I mean, in the 12 steps, you have them up on the wall. I mean, it says a lot, but I can really break it down to this. And it's been a journey of opening my heart, healing my past, and living with purpose, you know? That's the steps. That's the 12 steps right there. Opening my heart, healing my past, and living more purpose. Because the spiritual journey is a journey of healing. You know, we all come in here broken. And even people that aren't Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, everybody has a brokenness and a darkness to them, you know. People will try and tell you that they don't, but that's just nonsense, you know. Everybody does. Everybody has something. So, the longer I've been on this journey and the more I've wakened up, the more vision I've had to see back into my life. And I've got a memory. My short-term memory's terrible. You know, I couldn't tell you what way I got here. Honestly, I couldn't, you know. But if you want to talk about stuff that, you know, resentments I had when I was 4 or 5 years old, yeah, I mean, I'll give you details on them, you know. I mean, I have a good long-term memory. And I remember back, strangely enough, to, you know, when I was like 2 years of age, and there being like a lightness and a connectedness and a oneness in my life. I'm the youngest of a significantly large Irish family, and I'm significantly younger, you know. My oldest sibling's like 11 years, then 10 years, then it's 8 years, then it's like 5 years, you know. And, you know, I felt a lot of love, and I felt a lot of connection, you know, in my life. I don't believe I'm one of these guys that God made me alcoholic. I don't think God makes alcoholics. I don't think he does. You know, he definitely didn't make me one. You know, I don't think I was born with alcoholism. And you can go into the whole DNA thing and all. Maybe there's a debate there or whatever. I don't know. But I remember my early days where there was just love and there was a connectedness. And I remember feeling a warmth. And I grew up in a good home. You know, I come from good people, good stock, you know. And like every family, you know, we had our problems and stuff. But there was a lot of love in my family. And, you know, somewhere in there, it kind of went away, you know. And we talk about children, you know, in the terrible twos, you know, when they're like 2 years of age and stuff. And I think a lot of, for many years, you know, I said that, oh, you know, my nephew, he's in the terrible twos, he's pulling toys down, he's ripping things up and stuff. And I didn't know why he was in the terrible twos, you know. And I don't think most people do. And the reason for that is because we start to develop a sense of self. You know, we start to develop a sense of self around that age. I mean, you want to see how the spiritual life is lived perfectly? Watch a 16-month-year-old kid. Watch him live the spiritual life. Roll around on the floor, laughing, you know. You give him the kind of baby food and in the tub, and he just lifts it and he just dumps it on his head, you know, and just laughs at you, you know. You know, it's just because there's no sense of anything there. It's just love. It's just connectedness. And then, you know, when I started to kind of like live in this world, I started to develop fear. You know, I started to develop a mind, started to develop this ego. And I remember it being very judgmental from the beginning. And, you know, on top of that, I grew up in a society where it was just brutally violent. You know, there was no violence in my home. I grew up in West Belfast. You know, you probably figured out already, I'm not from around here, you know. I'm not from this zip code, and there's geographics in my story, you know. But, you know, I grew up in West Belfast, in, you know, in the midst of a religious war, a heated religious war with a wall down the center of the community that was 60 feet high in some areas, you know, where like concrete and steel to separate Protestants and Catholics. And, you know, it was crazy. I mean, they killed each other and, you know, they blew each other up. And the society that I grew up in was so different to what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, we don't build walls in Alcoholics Anonymous. We build bridges, right? You know, we talk about unity in here, not diversion. And where I grew up, like there's two cultures living like two streets apart. One reads one newspaper, one reads the other. One follows one football team, one follows the other. You know, one listens to one kind of music, one goes to one church. You know, it was like so diverse. And I grew up in that. And remember, you know, my earliest memories after that were just fearful ones. I remember the British soldiers like driving down the street in their tanks and stuff, and like standing behind my mom like full of fear, you know, and them kind of walking around with their guns and stuff and kind of wondering what was going on. And I can tell you guys, by the time I was finished kindergarten, I could have done with a six pack, you know. I could have, like, I was, you know, my life before I picked up a drink, I was getting primed for alcohol. I really was. And the other thing on top of that too, like the culture that I grew up in, I mean, it's a drinking culture still to this day, you know. And it makes me laugh how alcohol and drink is kind of like it's etched into that culture. And, you know, the more I think of this, the more I laugh. You know, I was home in Ireland a couple of years ago, and I was out walking with one of my nephews. He's like in his 20s, you know, he's got kids and all, and we're walking down the road, and we're walking past this hospital. It's a hospital that I was in many times as a result of my alcoholism and getting stitched up, and I was in the psych ward in that hospital and stuff where, you know, my drinking and stuff had brought me to. And we're walking past the hospital, and my nephew goes, do you not think it's weird, Adrian, we have a bar in the hospital? You know? And I just burst out laughing. He goes, what are you laughing at, man? That's crazy. I said, no, it makes perfect sense to me, buddy. It really does, you know. And we do. We have a bar in the hospital there, you know. I mean, just in case, you know. You kind of need it, like, you know. And by the time I was 10, like, you know, I'd already had experiences with alcohol. You know, I'd already been drunk before the time I was 11 years of age. I'd blacked out at a Christmas party in my mom's house and went up into the attic. And, you know, I remember blacking out and coming to and thinking to myself, well, I'm not going to do that again. So technically speaking, I'd quit drinking twice by the time I was 11, you know. And I was one of these guys that swore that I was never going to do it. And, you know, the alcoholism was in, you know, it was rampant in my family. You know, I had aunts that were pretty bad alcoholics, uncles. I watched one of my best friend's father, he died at the bottom of our street. No socks, no shoes on. Lying on the street talking to the dogs, you know, that were passing him by. You know, bottle to lips. I remember stepping over drunks on the way into school. Like, they were lying there with old cheap bottles of wine. Belfast was a city where there was a lot of street drunks, male and female. And that's one of the hardest things I think I've ever had to see, is a female street drunk lying there with her face biased open and stuff, you know, with a, you know, asking for a couple of coppers. And if I had ever any reason not to go on the path that I went on, like, you know, it was in my face. You know, this book talks about it talks about a circle and triangle in here when we start, and that's where when I'm bringing someone through the steps in my sitting room, or we're sitting in a coffee shop or whatever, that's where it starts for me right there. Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. You know, there's a circle and a triangle in there. And the man that I came in contact with at the beginning of my journey, you know, they were big on this circle and triangle, and they told me the story of how it was removed from the editions before 1976 and stuff. And it was revealed to me that, you know, this circle and triangle that we see all around Alcoholics Anonymous, unity, service, and recovery, it's like a three-legged stool, you know? It's our three-part solution. It's the three-part solution to the illness of alcoholism. So if there's a three-part solution, there must be a three-part problem, you know? And it was explained to me that if one of this three-legged stool, this structure, if one of these legs is missing, then the structure's going to flip over, it's going to fall. Or if you lean too heavily on one side or two sides, you know, it's going to fall, the structure's going to fall. And I had experience of that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The first time I came to AA was, I'd just spent like 4 days in a psych ward, and I'd come off the back of a really bad bender. So I had one of them benders. My benders normally started about Wednesday night or Thursday night, you know, when I got some money in my pocket and I got a couple of days rest and some food in my stomach and that. And off it started again, you know. Thursday night I'd start drinking. It would go in through to Friday. Normally by Sunday morning or Monday morning, I'd be in some apartment or some flat somewhere in some part of Belfast where people that I didn't know were techno music blasting, you know, my shirt off, drinking drinks that I'd never tried before, you know. And it just had went the whole way through. There may or may not have been arrests in that period of time. I may or may not have visited the hospital in that period of time. I may or may not have had a black eye. You know, that's what my drinking was like right there. And when you come to on a Monday or a Tuesday or whatever after living like that, you got problems in your life. You know, you got problems. And every job I had, before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd lost. You know, I'd lost through drinking. I'd lost through not showing up. You know, most of them I didn't even get fired from. I just didn't go back. You know, I just didn't even go back. But it became evident to me that, you know, I had a problem. And the first guy to 12-step me was a really good friend of mine. He drank like me. He lived across the street from me, so he did. And he got into a bit of trouble, so he did, with the booze. And he said, you know, I really need help. And it was one of the first times in my life where my dishonesty actually helped someone. I remember it was around Christmas time, and I was really doing bad. I was drinking. I was doing non-conference approved substances. Are we allowed to talk about that in here? I'm not even going to start that, you know. You know, it's funny about drugs. I'm not a drug addict, you know. I experimented with drugs. That experiment lasted for about 12 years, you know. So make what you want out of it, you know. So, you know, this was my first kind of dealings with Alcoholics Anonymous. It was around Christmas time. My sister was home from London, and I was just out of it, you know. I'm on drugs. I'm drinking every day. I mean, one eye's going north. The other's going south. My chin, I can't hold it still. There's so much drugs in me, you know. I mean, I'm mixing whiskey with vodka and crystal meth and ecstasy. I'm like the first Irish man on the moon, you know. I mean, I don't know if I'm coming or I'm going, and I really scared my sister. And in one of these blackouts, I told her that I really needed help, and that, you know, I give her this whole big lecture, and apparently we sat there for like 4 hours, and she said, okay, the next morning, you know, we're going to get you help. And she came into my bedroom the next morning, and I didn't know what she was talking about, you know? And she says, I found a place, Shaftesbury Square Hospital in Belfast, and you're going to it today. I've set up an appointment with one of, and I'm like, Jesus, we're overreacting here. Like, we're definitely overreacting. I'm not ready for this, you know? This is crazy. But, you know, being the good alcoholic that I am, and I don't like to let people down, and, you know, I promised her the moon and the stars. Apparently, I told her that I'd go, but I didn't go. I went into the town to McDonald's and rolled a joint and got a Big Mac and sat there for a couple of hours and then came back and told her. And she says, what happened down there? I says, well, the good news is that I'm not an alcoholic and I'm not a drug addict. You know, the guy in the place said that I could smoke a joint and I could drink cider as long as I mixed it with blackcurrant. And my sister was like, that's strange. That's really strange, you know. And she says, well, it doesn't sound as bad as what you were doing. Within 2 hours, I had my sister in the bar buying me pints of cider and blackcurrant, you know. But I made a mental note of that place, Shaftesbury Square Hospital, because where I came from, there was no such thing as a detox or anything, and I qualified for a detox most weekends. I needed to go in there. I remember waking up on those mornings, like, and it was like poison coming through my veins, the alcohol, like dripping poison. The alcohol was just felt, it was like alcohol poisoning, and I was so sick, I just needed something. And I remember, I'd just lie in a bedroom with like the heat on full blast, and just kind of like just lie in there, and the demons would just come through me. Like, I remember having the DTs, like snakes in the bed with me and up screaming. And, you know, I got up one night and it was so bad, like the hell was so bad. I remember getting up one night and putting my head through the window, and my dad had to come into the room like and hold me down. It was pretty bad, you know, what I put my parents through. I was still living in the house at that time. And my friend got... he got in trouble with the booze, and he came to me, and I says, well, I have a place where you can go. And I brought him to that place, and he went in there, and I remember going to see him after he'd been in there for about 2 weeks, and when I went in to visit him, he changed already. And he started to tell me about, he was going to these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that it had changed his life and stuff already, and that he was talking about he'd already started to do a 4th step and stuff. And it was all going over my head, you know. And he says, when we're having a family day up, I'd like you to come up and, you know, come up and see around what's happening. I said, no problem. And on family day, I showed up with the biggest case of Miller Genuine Draft that you could find. And the biggest, that's how much I knew back in those days, and it didn't bother him at all. And he told me that day, he says, see, when I get out of here, he says, I want to have a conversation with you, man. And when he got out of there, he came to me and he spoke to me. And he says, you know, man, I've known you a long time, and I really love you. And I don't. There's been times I don't think I've been a good friend to you, man. And I really regret that. And it was weird because, like, we don't talk like that in Belfast with each other, man. You just, you know, you're out drinking with your friend, and, you know, you hit him in the head with a bottle. Yeah. you cut him open, you go around to his house the next day and you go, listen, dude, I'm sorry about that. Come on, I'll buy you a drink, you know? But that's how it is, you know? I mean, that's kind of how it was, you know? And I was like, ooh, that, you know, touchy-feely kind of stuff. But what kind of sealed the day for me, he gave me a check. Apparently he owed me money that I didn't know about, and that must have been a first, you know? And he gave me a check for like a few hundred, and he says, listen, big man, if you ever need help, I got a place. I got a place that you can go, you know? And I think that's when my alcoholism really spiraled off into a bad place where I just couldn't control it, you know? What the doctor talks about in the doctor's opinion of this book, the phenomenon of craving, the physical allergy. I didn't have that terminology back then. I mean, you don't before you get here. It's like being locked in a cave and all this stuff's going on. You're experiencing this stuff every day and you don't have the language for it, you know? And it's like a German Shepherd dog has like a little rag doll in its mouth and it's just running with it and it's just pulling it around the place and doing whatever it wanted with it. That's what the booze was doing to me, you know? One humiliating experience after another. You know? I remember praying. I mean, and I remember talking to my sponsor about this when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember praying before I'd go out drinking that the trouble wouldn't be too bad, you know? Because there was a lot of violence. There was a lot of kind of crazy macho stuff and, you know, stitches and staples and fractured skulls and all that stuff. And I remember I would pray before I'd go drinking and I remember my sponsor saying to me, so why didn't you just not go drinking? You know? And I didn't have an answer for him. He says, that's powerlessness right there. That's powerlessness, you know? And I would go on these runs, and they were getting worse, and they were getting worse, and they were getting darker. And I couldn't understand. Well, when I did start working, all I wanted to do was, after work on a Friday, was go into the bar and have a couple of drinks. You know? Just one or two, three drinks, just to take the edge off. And there I'd be, closing the bar that night at 12 o'clock, still in my work clothes and stuff. And, you know, I didn't have great jobs. I had these, like, dead-end construction jobs where you would have had to kill the owner of the company to lose them, you know? And, I couldn't understand why I couldn't put it down. I thought I was a weak-willed person, you know? I remember my girlfriend, she was pregnant, and, you know, she was in hospital having the baby, which, you know, she ended up losing. But I remember I was out partying, I was out drinking, and everybody was calling me, and I knew what they were telling me, and I knew what they wanted me to do, but I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. Because I'm a kind of guy, once I put that booze in my system, no matter where I am, I have to finish the job. I have to continue drinking. I can't just stop it, you know? I don't have the power to shut it off. And there was many experiences like that. And I didn't feel good about that, you know. I didn't. I thought I was this weak-willed person who was just a bad person, you know. And I'll tell you, I'm not a weak-willed person. It takes a lot of willpower to work a construction job, to stay up drinking all night, and to go home at 7 o'clock in the morning, jump in the shower, and go in the middle of the heat in July and work on a construction site all day again, sick, throwing up, swearing to yourself that you're never going to do it again, and something magical seems to happen around 2 o'clock, you know, where you actually go to the bar, and, you know, you've spent a day hating yourself, hating everyone, you know, you're already halfway through the work, and next week's wages is spent, you know, and you know, that's what my life looked like, and it was kind of crazy, and I would go on these runs, and I come off the back of one of these runs where I just didn't want to do it anymore, you know, and I just, there was no way out, you know. The only tools that I had to deal with that was just to pick up the drink again. And if you're living the way that I'm living, alcohol's the great remover, you know, and if you look at it like from the beginning till the end of your drinking career, it's ever so crafty at the beginning, you know, it picks your pocket ever so gently, you know, and you make it locked up for a night, you know, I mean, it removes that from you, your freedom for a night, and then it starts to remove your mother's pocketbook, and then it starts to remove your father's life savings, and it starts to take away the innocent relationships in your life, and it's the great remover. It'll take the pain to your car alcohol, and it'll come back for the lining of your stomach and finish you, it'll take your mind. And I think that's the place I was at where it actually took my mind to the point where, you know, I couldn't go on. I came to the place that this book talks about, that lonely place that where such few go, you know, that jumping off place where you can't imagine life with booze or you can't imagine life without it. See, I couldn't imagine a happy, fulfilled life without alcohol or drugs. I didn't think it was possible. I really didn't, you know. And when your mind's that size from alcoholism, that's all you can see. You can't see the bigger picture, you know. And, you know, I remember trying to take my life that time, and it was pretty close. I remember, you know, waking up in a psych ward after being rushed with the paramedics and stuff to the hospital, and just feeling, you know, it's really hard to articulate how I felt down in that psych ward after almost dying. I took so much drugs that my organs and everything in my body were just like mashed, you know. And I remember the shrink getting the flashlight and shining it in my eyes, and he's saying, you know, are you going to do it again? Are you going to do it again? Well, whatever it was you took, son, he says, you've done the job. But we got you here in time. You're going to be okay. And I remember my father squeezing my hand in that psych ward, and he was crying when I was kind of coming around, and I was lying in there for a few days. And it's amazing the people that God puts in your life even before you get the Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the people that helped you. Like my grandmother running, like, blocks away to get my sister to come back when she found me that day, you know. My friend that just got out of prison after doing a 14-year sentence, you know, and the day he gets out of prison and comes to my house, I'm in the hospital and that's happened. And he came to the hospital to visit me, and I remember, like, waking up and he's sitting at the side of my bed, and I thought that he'd escaped from prison. I couldn't believe that he was sitting there. And he said, what happened? You know, what's going on? And I said, I have an appendicitis, you know. And he just looked at me and he started crying. And he says, listen, I'm only out of the clink after doing quite a bit of time. And I know what you've done. You don't have to tell me what you've done. I've seen this many times in prison. He says, see, when you get out of here, I'm bringing you for help. And I just told him that I would to get him off my back, you know. And, you know, true to his word, he brought me to the chaplain of the prison, who was a priest, who was also a psychologist. And that's the first person I ever heard when I sat down to talk to him. That's the first person I ever heard that called me an alcoholic that I actually heard it. You know? And the first question he asked me was, he says, how much do you drink? And I shaved it in half, like, you know, I mean, because that's a kind of touchy question. People shouldn't ask that, you know, how much you kind of drink, or, you know. And he says, you're an alcoholic, son. And he says, it doesn't matter what kind of psychology work or whatever you do, you need to find recovery, you know. And I remember going to the Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time that time with my friend and sitting in here and looking up at them steps on the wall and stuff and just being afraid, you know. They were talking about rigorous honesty in here. They were talking about making amends. They were talking about doing a fourth step. And I'd done nothing. I just sat in here, you know, with my hands in my pockets, and the old-timers would come up to me. I'll never forget it because they were funny. Like, the old-timers in the group that I was in Belfast, they all had nicknames, you know. Harry the Heater. He was a plumber. You know, John the camera, he was a cameraman. And I'm sitting thinking, you know, what are they going to call me? You know, I better get out of here quick before they call me Adrian the condom or something. You know, I'm like, this is the kind of madness that's going through my head, you know. And the old timers did come up to me with this book and would say, you know, son, what are you doing? We've seen you around here. What are you doing to stay sober? And I'd just tell them things like, you know, well, I got a new tattoo, you know, I mean, you know, you know, because that seems like a good idea, you know, you want to start getting your life together, right, you know, you know, get a new tattoo, join the gym, you know, fitness, you know, that's a big one too, grow a beard, that's another one, right, you know, all these things, anything except look inside myself, and I didn't know how to do that, you know, and, You know, looking back on all that stuff, I mean, that was all stuff that happened to me at the beginning. And I'm far removed from that story now. You know, I've been doing this deal almost 19 years in a couple of weeks. And sometimes I forget my story, and sometimes I forget how connected I am to it until I hear someone share something. That's why it's so important that I bring people through this book and keep that connection, you know. Something that just popped into my head there. As this is a big book meeting, and it's an adapter's opinion, and this is something that I do with guys that XXVI, I have a third edition here, and it says, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy. that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up in them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. That's how I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. Problems, just problems, you know. And how my mind worked back then, you know, it's ironic. But I have to talk to a newcomer today to kind of remember how my mind worked back then, because it doesn't work that way anymore. You know, when you have, when you waken up spiritually in here, well, sorry, I should say me, your mind changes, you know, your mind wakens up as well. You know, I'm not saying that it's still broken in ways and it doesn't work in ways and it doesn't play tricks on me, but the mind wakens up as well. But I remembered my breaks in between drinks. I would sit in my mother's front room. It was a little 8-foot by 4-foot room with a television that I didn't even turn on. I didn't need one because I had full entertainment in here, you know. And, you know, the plates in the china cabinet would just rattle, and I'd just sit, tuned into it, and it would be one, you know, it would be one trip after another. And it was like, you know, the ego, like back then, it's like a dog with a bone, you know. It goes out on the street and it finds a bone, it brings it in, it drops it on your table. And the ego just goes and gets a problem and drops it on your table, right? You don't have a girlfriend, you know. And even if you did have a girlfriend, you don't have any money to buy or anything because it's Christmas next week, you know? And problem, problem, problem. And now I've got anxiety, and I would just sit there full of anxiety and full of fear and full of regret, you know? Living my life looking in a rearview mirror, and this is when I'm not drinking, you know? If I had stayed with her, if I hadn't broke up with her, you know? If I had kept that job, if I had done this, how much money do I have? And it would just go on and on and on and on and on. And there's nothing left for me to do but to just drink. At that moment, we talk about restlessness, irritable, and discontentment in Alcoholics Anonymous. Why are we restless, irritable, and discontented? Why? Well, I found out why I am. Because I rely upon something that can't be relied upon. My mind can't be relied upon. But when that's the only thing you know, what else can you rely upon? And that's what makes Alcoholics Anonymous in this book so significant. You know? It's going to open the door for something else, because my mind used to be like a conveyor belt, just one fearful thought after another. There was never any break in it, you know. Sometimes I might have had a good day, you know. But, you know, that's how it was, just crippled with fear. And then you start to think that maybe you're something else. Maybe you think you're like a schizophrenic or some kind of mental disorder. And don't get me wrong, alcoholism is a total mental disorder. Anybody who's willing to put their family and everything on the line to pick up a drink, there's something not right with their head. You know, there's really not. But that's how I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's something about that paragraph that I read out. You know, I'm bringing a guy through the steps at the minute, and he's sober about 10 years. And, you know, I got him when we'd done this, because we're doing the whole book again. And I got him to bring that paragraph there into meditation. And ask yourself, play it through in a prayerful and visionary way. What would it look like at 10 years? With all the things that you have in your life, he owns his own business now. He's got a baby on the way. He's got everything that he has in his life is like mine. It's a result of doing this in Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, what would your life look like now if you went back out and picked a drink up at 10 years? And I had that done on me when I had about 13 years. And I'll tell you, I couldn't sit in that space for too long. I really couldn't. That's a scary thought, you know. And I think there's a delusion in Alcoholics Anonymous, once you have time, that it's not going to happen to you again. And I'm very in touch with the proper idea that I fall into a category of people that die drunk, you know, and that I got to stay on my game here no matter what, no matter how long I'm here, really doesn't matter. It's what I'm doing, and the current experience. You know, I hear people talking about, I want to have a new experience with the steps all the time. What about your current experience? You know? What about your current experience with the steps? So it's good for me to get refreshed on that. And, you know, it goes on to talk about frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. I remember lying in that psych ward with my dad holding my hand, crying, my sister's asking me, you know, what can we do? What can we do to make your life better? And I don't even know what the problem is. You know, people are kind of like talking to me about a drinking problem, but it doesn't seem like it's a drinking problem to me. You know, it seems like a sobriety problem. You know, it seems like my main problem is in sobriety, you know. And the powerlessness of that whole situation after I promised them the moon and the stars. I get out of that psych ward, and the place where the run started on the Thursday night, way before that, I ended up on that bar stool again. You know, taking the hospital bracelet off my arm with all my information and stuff on it, crumpling it up and throwing it in the ashtray, saying, I'll have a double. And off it went again, the little rag doll in the German Shepherd's mouth, you know. And I couldn't shut it off until my last drink, you know. I mean, there was a lot of love came somewhere from the multi-universes or whatever, but within my last drink, there was another blackout. There was many blackouts within my last drink because it lasted for 3 days, and I was in and out of blackouts in there. And the very last blackout that I came out of, I was in a fight. And there was a guy in front of me, and his nose was just hanging right open. And his wife was with him, and she wasn't happy about what I'd done to her pretty husband's face, you know. And she'd done a number on my face too, you know. And I remember my buddy pulling me away that day. And I don't know why it happened that night, but he brought me to an after hours, and he gave me a drink, and that was the last drink I ever had. But I sobered up that night, and I said to myself, you know what, this is not going to happen again. I'm not going to do this again. And I never did. And I remember going home that night and, you know, getting down on my knees and asking this God that I was afraid to believe in, you know, would he help me? And I got back to Alcoholics Anonymous and I met Kevin, and he started to give me the language of what this really was, you know, phenomenon of craving, physicalology. The second time I met him, he started hitting me with this. Do you ever drink and you can't stop your drink? Every time, you know, phenomenon of craving, physicalology, you know, is there ever times when you say to yourself that you're not going to drink again and you end up drunk again? Every time, mental obsession, you know, and I got to tell you about the mental obsession, you know, I hear some wonderful stories in Alcoholics Anonymous, people coming in here like, you know, they're here 5 days, you know, they work the whole 12 steps in 5 days and they're good. I'd say for at least 18 months the obsession was on me. So it was. And I'm doing step work and I'm part of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it just, you know, that obsession took time to subside in me. It really did. You know, the obsessive thoughts would work on me like I would see it on a billboard or whatever, and I'd be just like tuning into it. I'd see it on TV. I'd be walking the NAA meeting on Saturday night, and I'd just see all the girls lining up to go into a club or whatever, and like it would just go off on me, you know. And if you're experiencing that, be honest about it, you know. Be honest. Say that you're gonna, you know. Say that that's what's going on. Just because someone else is having a different experience in here, you know. My experience with a mental obsession is it's not there anymore. Hasn't been for a long time. Can't remember when the last time the thoughts in my mind give me trouble over booze. You know, I can't remember that at all. The experience that I have where alcohol and Alcoholics Anonymous today, I mean, this journey, it talks about conceding to your innermost self in here. That means deep down inside yourself. I mean, you can say what you want in here tonight. You can say that your name's Michael, you're an alcoholic, and you know. But if you don't believe that deep down inside yourself, because I came to AA and said that many times. I said it when I was drunk, you know. But what happened to me this time when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, intellectually I would say that I concede to my innermost self that I'm done here, but emotionally I would never do it. And for the first time in my life, intellectually and emotionally together, I'd done that. I conceded. And that's where this journey started for me, right there, on that, being honest. There was a shift that took place. And that's a huge shift right there. That's a shift in your identity. So it is. That's a total shift in your identity. When you start the thoughts that you were so identified with for so many years, when the thoughts of alcohol would come up, you would just run with them like a dog chasing a car, and you'd be drinking. Now they're coming up and they don't seem to be your thoughts. You're just not attached to them. You know, but that took time for me to happen in here. That took time. And that's where that process started, conceding to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. And where that has brought me to today is a place in the 10-step promises where I'm no longer afraid of alcohol. I have a healthy respect for it, but I'm no longer afraid of it. And I hear people say that they have a healthy fear. for alcohol. I don't know if there is a such thing as a healthy fear, because fear is something that blocks me off from the power, and I don't think that's healthy. You know, if I have fear around alcohol, my own experience is with it, that there's something wrong with my spiritual status. Somewhere between steps 10 and steps 1, there's something needs to be looked at. There's something needs to be healed within me, you know. And then the deal that I've got here is that now, today, I can go back to Ireland, a sober man, go watch the football with my family, you know, go to the bar with them before the game, buy them alcohol and not actually want to drink it. You know, sit with them for a while, just for a while, just for a little while, you know, and then they start repeating the same story over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's time to go, you know. And I have a strange relationship with alcohol today, you know. When I go into a 7-Eleven or something, and I'm like in to get one of these or something, and I find myself at the beverages, the alcohol beverages in the fridge. I'm like, oh, wow, look at that, that's alcohol. It has to be brought to my attention, you know. And there's something in me, it's like, wow, that's like disgusting. It's like it repulses me, you know, just to think that I would kind of want to drink that today, you know. It's like a different person showing up in my life today, you know. And that's the way it stays, as long as, you know, I talked about two aspects of the illness there. I know I don't have much time left, but, you know, I talked about two aspects of the illness where the mental obsession comes long before the physical allergy takes place. You know, the physical allergy takes place when I put alcohol in my body. You know, if I'm sitting in a meeting at 2 years sober talking about the compulsion to drink, that's the mental obsession, because the compulsion doesn't happen until I actually put the alcohol in my body. I never knew that. I never did, you know. I never knew that once I had two or three drinks, I was off to the races, and this phenomenon of craving would take place within me. And this phenomenon of craving, it's a phenomenon. We don't know what it is. We still don't know what it is. Science doesn't know what it is. Say I was playing football out there where Mike, and, you know, he jumps on me and gives me a bad tackle, and he breaks my arm, and he brings me over to the hospital, and they bring me in, and they put me on an x-ray machine, and they x-ray me up, and, all right, Adrian, you broke your arm, and there's a hairline fracture down here, and we're going to do this to fix it or whatever. If I go to a bar across the street right now and at 19 years sober and have two or three drinks, it's guaranteed that that allergic reaction to the alcohol is going to it's going to kick off again, because I've sponsored many guys that have had double digits of brandy that went back drinking again, and it happened, boom, just like that, just like they'd never left the bar, 10, 15, 20 years later. And if I go over and I have those few drinks and they bring me down into the hospital, they can't put me on a screen and go, well, that's the phenomenon of craving right there. They just don't know, but it's there. It's like part of my, it's built into my soul, and that's never going to go. So if I don't have the mental obsession, then the allergy can't happen. But what makes the mental obsession happen? What makes the thought process continue for me to think that it'll be okay? Looking up at one of those billboards going, it would be all right to have a freezing cold bottle of cider today, because it takes the edge off. It takes the edge off what? It takes the edge off how I'm feeling. That restlessness, that irritability, that discomfort with life, you know? And there's so many ways we can talk about that spiritual malady, that spiritual sickness. I think, you know, I think the best paragraph I've ever seen on untreated alcoholism ever is on page 52. You know, the bedevilments, you know. So if my life looks something like this, there's something not right. You know, on page 52 it says we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply our human problems, this same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with our personal relationships. You know, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous on a collision course, you know, I remember there was a guy that was trying to help me out in AM Belfast. I had about 2 weeks sober, and he called me up to see how I was doing. I told him, I'm doing great. I'm flying. It's brilliant. Haven't drank in 2 weeks. How's things going at work? Well, my boss is an SOB, you know. My mom, I've been putting big books under her pillow, you know. She needs to get this too. And my dad, and he's like, you're not doing well at all, buddy, that's resentment. I'm like, is that what that is? I was so identified with it, I didn't know that there was a difference. He goes, yeah, that's what that is. So I'm having trouble with my personal relationships. Couldn't control my emotional nature, can't get out of bed in the morning. I've got the bed sheets up over my head. I'm so full of fear. I got all this going on at the same time, you know. We were a prey to misery and depression. Couldn't make a living. And I think all that means is there is that I can't find a job that'll support me and I'm happy doing. I could never find that in my life, you know. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. I love talking to newcomers about stuff like this. Or anybody that's experiencing that, because it looks like they have a whole bunch of problems. But it's really only one problem. It's really only one problem. And I listen to newcomers' problems. I listen to the relationship problems and stuff. I'm not one of these staunch guys that like, I don't have the relationships. That's nothing to do with this. Of course it's something to do with this. It's all something to do with it. So I listen to guys and I'll let them go on and go on and go on for a while. And then I'll say to them, listen, dude, here's the deal. We don't have answers to your problems in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't. What we have is a solution to alcoholism. And in finding that solution to alcoholism, you'll find the answers to your problems. It's as simple as that. Would you like some help? Would you like to do this? And what happens is, you watch these guys over a period of a month, 2 months, 3 months, you watch the problems fall away. You know, sometimes it peaks a little bit first, and you're hearing it on the phone, and then when they're doing this, when they've done their fourth step, and they've done their fifth step, and they're right there making amends, the problems start to fall away. Because they're not really problems. What's happening is, I'm getting reconnected with that source. I'm getting reconnected with that love. I told you I'd get the word love in there, Mike. I'm getting reconnected with that love that I had when I was an infant. And that's what this is. It's a journey back to my higher self, my highest self, or whatever you want. That's what the spiritual life is. You know? It's just a ripping away of all these masks and all these ideas and all these beliefs and everything that I've had. I look at alcoholism as, I look at it as a gift today. It's something that got me back on this path and got me marching back to who and what I really am. You know, and I don't fully know what that is. I wouldn't really be able to give you an answer on who and what I really am. You know, there's the physical aspect of me here and there's the spiritual aspect of me and stuff. I think I've got more in touch with it, you know, but I wouldn't really be able to tell you what that is. And how that journey began for me was going through this book, you know. You know, I've worked with a lot of different spiritual stuff, different teachers. I've worked with shamans, I've worked with energy workers, horse whisperers, all different kinds of people. And I got to tell you, nothing has opened the door on my spiritual journey like the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where it started for me. And everything seems to come around full circle again. That's where it started for me, and this is where I'm at right now. That's the beautiful thing about this, whether you're the young lady, welcome by the way, we're 15 days, or one of the old timers in the room, that's the beautiful thing about this book. It'll meet you where you're at. It'll meet you where you're at on your journey. You know, the words in this page can mean one thing to somebody we're 15 days, and it can mean another thing to someone we're 15 years, and not just have a meaning, but be transformative to bring you past where you're at. And that's what we want to do, right? When we're struggling, we want to get past where we're at. So, I don't know. I'm looking forward to doing the next 3 weeks here. You know, hopefully as I've got to know me a little bit better and identify myself. I think that's important to identify myself as an alcoholic here tonight. You know, I'm a little bit distracted because there's like a big game or something on tonight, isn't it? But that's it. I don't even call that football. I'm a real football fan. They actually play with the ball, you know? You know, so I believe it's over to you guys now, so thanks for letting me share.